President Trump's political operative Roger Stone is on trial today. At the heart of the case, his relationship with WikiLeaks.
And keep in mind that although they don't want to say this in so many words, the U.S. intelligence community believes that WikiLeaks is a cutout for Russian intelligence.
Also today, we visit a migrant shelter near the U.S.-Mexico border in Tijuana that gives kids a place to be at ease.
Where does beauty fit into, you know, the tragic lives of a migrant or refugee? But all the more reason for beauty.
And a colony of Polish ants took a detour.
The ants in question were found to be living right on top of an abandoned nuclear bunker. Everything would have been fine, except for a pesky ventilation pipe.
The Great Escape meets radioactive Polish ants. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us today. The U.S. and Mexico are looking for common ground after a brutal episode last night. At least 9 members of a family of dual U.S.-Mexican citizens were gunned down in an ambush in northern Mexico. President Trump said it's time for the U.S. to help Mexico wage war on drug cartels. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador thanked Trump for his willingness to help.
Pero cuidando.
But López Obrador also added Mexico's sovereignty must be preserved. Last night's attack was grisly, even by the standards of organized crime in Mexico. The victims, 3 women and 6 children of the LeBaron family. Angela Cocherga is a reporter in El Paso and has previously reported on the family. What do we know about the specifics of the attack, Angela?
Well, we know that these 3 vehicles driven by women with children came under some sort of attack or ambush, and it's unclear if they exploded because there was gunfire that hit a gas tank or some other way were set on fire.
Is it known whether the family was targeted in this attack?
We don't know that, and it's a very preliminary investigation. These are kind of lawless pockets of northern Mexico that they were traveling through. It was a caravan with 3 vehicles, large SUVs. Sometimes are used very often by narco groups, so it could have been mistaken identity. Then again, it would be pure speculation. We don't know why this family, these women and children, came under attack.
So the LeBaron family has a presence in this region of northern Mexico. You reported on a previous violent attack against them. What is the history of this family?
So this family moved from the U.S. to Mexico in the late 1800s. A few years ago, when violence spiked in the region, in this border state of Chihuahua, they too suffered first a kidnapping for ransom of a 16-year-old boy in the town. That teenager was returned unharmed, but later a group of armed men came to a family gathering and pulled 2 of the LeBaron family men out of the home and shot and killed them. That sparked a huge outcry from the community. They took up arms and started patrolling their own town and trying to protect themselves from what they called cartel violence.
If the LeBaron family was so outspoken against the cartels, doesn't the mistaken identity theory kind of lose some plausibility?
We really don't know. It's purely speculation. They could easily have been targeted. Now, the leaders of the LeBaron family have been outspoken for years. I mean, dating back to 2 presidents ago. So this is not something new, but they are very outspoken right now. They're furious.
The headline a lot of people heard this morning was Mormon family attacked. What does their religion have to do with all of this?
It really has nothing to do with it. The Mormons have existed in Mexico for generations. The LeBaron family, they do not stand out. They are very well integrated in Mexico, accepted members of the community. They've been in state government and federal government. So they are very much fully Mexican citizens, but also dual nationals, U.S. citizens who go back and forth and have strong ties on both sides of the border. So there's no reason to believe that religion had anything to do with this attack.
So, Angela, as you said, the LeBaron family has criticized state and federal governments for not doing enough to restore law and order in parts of Mexico controlled by these cartels. Today, we saw President Trump tweeting that, quote, if Mexico needs or requests help in cleaning out these monsters, the United States stands ready, willing, and able to get involved because, he continues, sometimes need an army to defeat an army. Do you think military action will be taken in this case?
Mexico's president said he welcomes help. He'll talk to President Trump about this. But Mexico has its own military fighting this fight. There's lots of cooperation when it comes to organized crime and drug trafficking, but not actual troops crossing into Mexico to hunt down drug cartel members in towns like LeBaron.
Have you seen any reaction from anybody in the LeBaron family about Trump's tweet?
Yes. One of the LeBaron patriarchs responded directly and said, as far as help, focus on lowering drug consumption in the U.S. and stop gun law loopholes from injecting high-powered assault weapons into Mexico. So real concern about concrete actions that can be taken on the part of the U.S. that is much more than just offering to send troops to go after very elusive drug trafficking members.
Reporter Angela Kucherga in El Paso, Texas, thanks very much for your time. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
500 miles west from where the LeBaron family was attacked is Tijuana. It's also a violent part of Mexico, and it's a hub for migrants waiting to enter the U.S. There are shelters in Tijuana that try to provide refuge for them. Walk up a winding, narrow street to the top of a steep hill, and you'll find one of those shelters. These days, it's home mostly to Mexicans who are fleeing cartel violence elsewhere in their country. As KQED Sasha Coca reports, it's also the first shelter in Tijuana to team up with American school teachers who want to open a preschool for the youngest children waiting at the border.
Adultos, adultos, ¿no vas a comer? ¿No quieres?
Leticia Herrera Hernandez, everybody calls her Doña Leti, is ladling out beans onto paper plates. She runs this Catholic shelter, which on this day is housing more than 150 people, crammed in three rooms and two makeshift spaces outside, sharing four bathrooms, one washing machine, entire families on a single mattress. But across the street, it's a different scene. In a light-filled house, children are painting while listening to classical music, building with colorful magnetic blocks, wooden toys, crayons organized by color in rows of glass jars. It's spacious and orderly and beautiful.
Where does beauty fit into, you know, the tragic lives of a migrant or refugee? But all the more reason for beauty, because everyone needs beauty in their life, and they're sure not getting it.
This is Elise Schaefer-Ivy. She ran a private early childhood education center in Santa Monica for decades before creating this informal preschool called The Nest.
A lot of these children are in a state of suspended childhood. You know, like their childhood just ended on that day when suddenly mom or dad just said, you know, we're leaving.
She's watching a three-year-old named Kevin playing with colorful silk scarves. He's waving them over a clear plastic tube attached to a fan. So the pieces of silk shoot up into the air. Again, again, he shrieks. Kevin and his mom arrived at Doña Leti's shelter here 2 months ago from Michoacán. A violent cartel was extorting people for money, kidnapping and killing them. So Kevin's mom, Julieta, we're not using her real name for safety reasons, got on a bus for Tijuana. Kevin arrived shaken and angry. Julieta says he had a hard time at the shelter. He would hit other kids and yell at them.
Él ha cambiado mucho, ya no pelea, ya convive más con los niños porque
Julieta says since The Nest opened in September, Kevin's learned to listen better. She doesn't have to grab him so he pays attention. Research shows kids who have a hard time adjusting socially before the age of 5 have a lot of trouble catching up. Elise says if kids like Kevin can play away from the crowded shelter, it could give him some sense of stability.
This isn't a Band-Aid solution. This isn't sweetening the day of a child who might be stuck on a mattress in a shelter. I mean, yes, of course we're sweetening the day of that child, but it's so much more than that. This is about really setting a trajectory that will have impact.
The whole idea of The Nest started with a trip Elise took to Greece. She happened to meet a relief worker there who invited her to visit a refugee camp, then home to mostly Syrian and Afghan migrants.
They're digging in the dirt for, they were playing with nails in their pockets. They had old cigarette lighters that they had found. I mean, there was nothing for children.
Back in Los Angeles, Elise raised enough cash to set up an education program for those kids in Greece, and eventually one in the Congo. While building these nests around the world, Elise was painfully aware of migrant families at the border, not far from her home in L.A. When she visited Doña Leti's shelter in Tijuana, the two women clicked.
Los niños se la pasaban con el celular y haciéndole berrinches a la mamá. Y nosotros tratando de que jueguen, de que se entretenga.
Leti had already set up a makeshift elementary school next to her shelter in an old bus. But she had nothing for younger kids. She says they were just playing on their parents' phones most of the day.
Ahora a ellos los veo, el niño cambia.
Now Leti says she's really seen the kids change a lot. You can see it in their faces.
Completamente. El niño no puede fingir.
Leti and Elise make an unlikely pair. Elise doesn't speak a word of Spanish and was raised Jewish. Leti is a devout Catholic who sees Elise coming to set up the school across the street as a blessing.
La lista de la cocina se las voy a pasar y no quiero que me hagan cambios.
Leti's hair is disheveled as she scrambles to carry boxes of donated milk and cereal up the steep stairs to the shelter. She used to focus a lot more on her appearance. She owned a beauty salon, traveled the world, lived an upper-class life here in Tijuana. But one day, everything changed. Her son was killed in a car accident.
El día que él muere, a mí se me destrozó la vida. Y de todo aquello que yo creía que me importaba, no me importaba nada. Absolutamente nada, o sea...
She says nothing seemed important anymore. A priest urged her to channel her pain into helping people. One day, a friend asked her to help pass out food to homeless migrants.
Y empiezo a pensar cómo poner un albergue, cómo hacer para tener una casa para ellos.
Leti was so moved by what she saw, she connected with a Catholic charity and found a space for a shelter. Across the street at the nest, Elise notices that one of the silk scarves little Kevin floated up into the air has caught on a ceiling fan way above his head.
Kevin, you can't reach. What should we do?
Elise encourages Kevin and some other kids to lug in a heavy ladder, then figure out where to position it to climb up and get the scarf down.
I wonder if we move the ladder, if that would be helpful.
¿Quieres mover la escalera?
Sí.
This is the kind of autonomous decision-making kids need, she says, especially migrant kids who haven't had much choice in what's happened so far in their young lives. At the end of the day, Elise welcomes a dozen parents staying at the shelter to an orientation. She introduces a teacher from California. The nest is staffed by teachers from the U.S. who use their vacation time to come and volunteer.
There's wine and non-alcoholic beverages as well.
Elise serves wine and cheese on little plates, just like at her high-end preschool in Santa Monica. And there's discussion of brain science and why memorizing ABCs and numbers isn't enough. Elise encourages the parents to try out the magnetic wall, the light table, the clay. And then, like the preschoolers do each day, the parents act in a short play they write. This one is by Kevin's mom, Julieta, and it's a take on Little Red Riding Hood. She pretends to be a grandmother walking hunched over to meet a wolf. Elise and Leti say it's the first time they've seen Julieta smile. Then Julieta sits down at a child-size easel and paints a picture of a building that looks like a home.
¿Y este es el albergue o tu casa?
Is that your house or the shelter, I ask her.
El nido.
It's the nest, she says, a place where she and her son finally feel safe. For The World, Sasha Coca, Tijuana, Mexico.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Iran is pulling further away from the 2015 nuclear deal. President Trump abandoned the agreement last year, as you recall, and now Iran says it will begin injecting gas into centrifuges to enrich uranium that can be used to make reactor fuel or nuclear weapons. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said the step is reversible if other nations uphold their commitments. Arian Tabatabai is a political analyst with the RAND Corporation and joins us from Washington. Arian, help us understand what this means. How big of a deal are these latest moves by Tehran?
Well, this is the fourth step that Iran has announced over the past few months, further distancing itself from the commitments that it had undertaken under the nuclear deal. These steps have become progressively more challenging for the international community, the U.S. and Europe specifically. And this latest one is a pretty big political deal. So today, the announcement means that we are walking back toward Iran being able to enrich uranium there. And so in that sense, it is quite a departure from Iran's implementation of the deal.
So what can Iran actually do today that they could not do a week ago?
So what Iran is essentially saying that it will start doing as of tomorrow is that it will be injecting UF6 into a number of centrifuges that it is currently spinning in Fordo.
And UF6, what is that? The uranium gas that will enrich the uranium that they're currently spinning out in the centrifuges?
Right. So as part of the deal, Iran was still able to have a number of centrifuges there, but it wasn't going to use them for enrichment purposes. And so Iran is now taking steps toward walking back from the facility being a research and development facility and actually using it for nuclear activity.
So I guess what many listeners want to know, what I want to know, is does this mean Iran is getting closer to a bomb, and how close, how soon?
Well, eventually, if Iran continues to take more and more steps in the direction that we've seen so far, then yes, it will be able to get closer to acquiring enough fissile material for a nuclear weapon. But we shouldn't be jumping to conclusions today, because what Iran has announced is actually not that significant in terms of a technical capability to get closer to a nuclear weapon. So Iran still has quite some way to go. We're not facing an existential crisis quite yet, but the developments are certainly very far from ideal.
When does the existential crisis begin?
It's hard to say, because we don't really know what Iran's next steps are going to be. You know, there are a few things that could indicate that we are walking into that crisis. For example, if Iran decides as part of its next step to kick International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, if it decides to sort of revoke access to facilities from them and to kick them out, then we will have a much more concerning situation before us. Similarly, if Iran decides to just pull out of the deal altogether, as the United States did a year and a half ago, then we will be facing a much more problematic situation.
So Iranian President Hassan Rouhani gave the EU another 2-month deadline to try and salvage the deal. He warned of additional steps to break away from the deal if Europe did not help in supporting the Iranian economy. So what is Rouhani looking for in terms of economic support? And if he gets it, will he stay in the deal?
Well, the Iranians have long said that what they're actually looking for is a few things. They understand that the Europeans can't really circumvent U.S. sanctions. They can't provide Iran with the economic recovery that it had initially hoped for. So what the Iranians have said they want to see now is, one, the ability to sell their oil, and B, access to the financial infrastructure that any country needs in order to be able to do business. From my perspective, I think that, you know, it's going to be difficult for the Europeans to actually move forward in any significant way, and that we may be looking at an additional set of steps in the next few months.
Ariane Tabatabai with the RAND Corporation speaking with us from Washington. Thanks so much for your time, Ariane.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, maybe you saw this headline today, Cannibal Ants Escape Nuclear Bunker. Wow, I mean, that's like a real-life insect version of Sharknado. But the world's Jessica Yarmosky is here to say you can officially relax.
Let's get one thing out of the way. Yes, a million ants who had previously dabbled in cannibalism did, in fact, escape from an abandoned bunker in Poland. But instead of being scared, lots of people were really intrigued. See, for years, some scientists in Poland have been really into this one group of wood ants. So much so that they just published their second paper on the colony. The ants in question were found to be living right on top of an abandoned nuclear bunker. Everything would have been fine, except for a pesky ventilation pipe.
And through the ventilation pipe, those ants are falling down into the bunker.
And they can't get out. Hema Trigos-Perel is one of the researchers who's been following the ants living in the bunker. And that's the key word, living. Despite cold temps and a totally barren ecosystem, the ants below ground were surviving. How were they surviving? Corey Moreau is the director of the Cornell University Insect Collection. She says a lot of the ants in the bunker were worker ants.
So as those workers were falling down the air ventilation tunnel and landing in the bunker, they essentially were just going about their business. They were still interacting probably with the same number of workers, trying to find food, probably having to scavenge little bits of dead insects and other dead ants. They're just gathering food and sharing it with the colony, probably completely unaware that they're entirely detached from the rest of the colony.
Yes, they ate their dead friends. Well, parts of them. Here's Trigos Peral again.
They were making a small hole in the abdomen and eating what is inside, mainly proteins, but you also have some liquids and so on.
Cannibalism among ants isn't common, so the fact that they would turn to it in order to survive was one big finding. The scientists also wanted to see whether, given the opportunity, the ants would escape. So they installed a wooden plank, like a boardwalk, coming out of the pipe.
Just to check if ants prefer to go out or not.
And behold, the ants went marching, one by one, up and out of their nuclear prison. Now, not all of them escaped, and the hole above ground was still wide open, so even as some gained their freedom, others were still falling. But Moreau says the fact that many did choose to leave makes a lot of sense.
Even though these ants were surviving, and they were pretty resilient, as soon as they had the opportunity to go to a place where there was, you know, a much better life awaiting for them, right? More resources, more diversity of food sources. They immediately fled that bunker.
Resilient, yes. But given the chance, they'll escape their bunker. And really, who could blame them? For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
Right now, our newsroom is awash with leftover Halloween candy. Chocolates, gummy bears, you name it. We've been both repelled by it and inhaling it, which made this next story jump out at us. A New Zealand woman who was adrift at sea for 2 days surviving on hard candy. Here's what happened. Kushila Stein was hired to move a yacht from Turkey to Athens. During a stop, she decided to row a dinghy to shore, but she lost an oar and the wind swept her out to sea. 40 hours later, the Greek Coast Guard found her 55 nautical miles from where she started. Here's Stein after her rescue.
Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, I was blown away in my dinghy.
Stein did not have fresh water, but she rationed the handful of hard candy she happened to have with her. She still had one left when she was rescued. So the lesson, always grab a little candy when it's offered. You're listening to The World. Beirut was once called the Paris of the Middle East, but years of war took a toll.
There are these doorways that open out into two-story drops, rickety ladders that you're supposed to climb across to get to a new level. The staircases have crumbled.
Now Lebanon's capital is a center of protests. Coming up, Beirut through the eyes of its residents on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Another batch is out. House impeachment investigators today released two more transcripts from recent closed-door testimonies. These latest documents include the testimony of two key witnesses in the impeachment inquiry, U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland and the Trump administration's special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker. Here to help us take a deeper dive into these documents is The World's Matthew Bell. We're also joined by P.J. Crowley, who is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs for President Barack Obama. Matthew, what caught your eye starting with the testimony of U.S. Ambassador to the EU Gordon Sondland today?
Right. So just before his testimony came out, and that is a big document, 379 pages, I think it was. But just before that was released, there were 4 pages of additional testimony released just today from Sondland. And this gets very interesting because Sondland says after he heard some of the testimony, read the opening statements of previous witnesses at the House, his memory was jogged. And he's come out here with these several points. And the bottom line here is that Sondland really talks more explicitly about a quid pro quo linking U.S. military aid from the Trump administration with a promise from the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, to investigate corruption, including Burisma, the company that Hunter Biden was on the board, and also to have a White House meeting. So I think the headline here is that this quid pro quo that we've been talking about for weeks, it becomes more clear in those few pages than I've seen before.
PJ Crowley, Sondland's memory got jogged. How normal is that kind of statement?
Well, I think what struck me about the deposition is that initially he thought he was just trying to help organize a meeting between, you know, President Zelensky and President Trump. But over time, he came to understand that this was a bigger challenge, that in essence, the entire relationship between Ukraine and the United States under the Trump administration hinged on getting, you know, President Zelensky to commit publicly, you know, to these investigations.
What else stood out for you, PJ Crowley, in Ambassador Sondland's testimony?
This is going to be very difficult for defenders of President Trump to refute. You remember yesterday with the release of testimony by Marie Yovanovitch, the ambassador, former ambassador to Ukraine, there was some suggestion that she's an Obama holdover. Well, gee, she was appointed ambassador to Kyrgyzstan and ambassador to Armenia under President Bush. But Gordon Sondland and, as we'll talk about, Kurt Volker are both Trump appointees. They're both rock-solid Republicans. And both of them are telling us that, yeah, there was this quid pro quo.
Matthew Bell, the phrase, "I do not recall," comes up pretty frequently in Ambassador Sondland's testimony, right?
It does. There's a lot of details here, though, to go through. And I think it's pretty clear, you know, Sondland may be in some trouble himself. I mean, first of all, the statements are taken under oath. But as PJ said, he was clearly an actor in all of this. He, along with Rick Perry, the energy secretary, and Kurt Volker, the special envoy for Ukraine, called themselves the Three Amigos. And they were out there doing the work of the White House.
Let's turn to the testimony of Kurt Volker, PJ Crowley. What did we learn today from what we read there?
I think most compelling to me was the direct conversations that Kurt Volker, an extraordinarily experienced American diplomat, was having directly with Rudy Giuliani, saying that, you know, these former prosecutors, their stories were not credible. And yet, as we hear, in a meeting that he was a part of in the Oval Office, they had a profound impact in terms of the perception of the president towards Ukraine in general and the relationship in particular.
Do Republicans have a point when they say any president is empowered to pursue a foreign policy agenda, orthodox or unorthodox, and the White House has a fair amount of leeway to devise that policy?
Of course they do. Absolutely. But as we have heard, and I think we'll get a greater understanding when we get the full testimony of the chargé at the embassy in Kiev, William Taylor, is how this back channel through Rudy Giuliani was pursuing a separate policy than the one endorsed throughout the government, up to and including, you know, the Secretary of State, you know, Mike Pompeo. I think the other dimension here is that, you know, it is not unusual to have a special presidential envoy who sometimes can cut through bureaucracy and try to create opportunities for breakthroughs. But what we hear, particularly in Kurt Volker's explanation, and Gordon Sondland himself confirmed this with an eye roll with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, is how Giuliani's involvement was actually complicating the formulation and execution of American policy towards Ukraine, and understanding that that's highly problematic since, you know, Ukraine is a frontline state actively resisting Russian aggression, and yet we seem to be undermining that effort with what Giuliani in particular on behalf of the president was trying to achieve.
Matthew Bell, look ahead for us. What's coming next?
House investigators are continuing to invite witnesses. The White House continues to say it's not going to cooperate with this impeachment inquiry process. Just today, the House said that they want to have Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff from the White House, come in. And they say that he played a key role and might have had firsthand knowledge and information that's directly relevant to what they see as a linkage between the U.S. military aid and the investigating of Donald Trump's political rivals here. You can expect Mulvaney won't show up, but the Democrats are saying that's just going to be added to the list of what they see as obstruction.
More to come. The World's Matthew Bell, as well as PJ Crowley, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs under President Barack Obama. Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
The self-proclaimed dirty trickster went on trial today. That would be Roger Stone, a political operator close to President Trump. Stone is charged with lying to Congress, obstruction of justice, and witness tampering. Stone's personal mantra, deny everything. So this might not come as a huge surprise. His plea today, not guilty. During the 2016 election, Stone presented himself to the Trump campaign as a conduit to WikiLeaks, which was releasing hacked documents damaging to the Democrats and Hillary Clinton. Stone later denied a WikiLeaks connection. John Schindler is a former National Security Agency analyst and counterintelligence officer. Briefly, who is Roger Stone, John?
Roger Stone is a self-proclaimed, essentially lifelong political trickster for the Republican Party who's had a shadowy and up-and-down career and only really became a household name because of his involvement with Donald Trump in his 2016 campaign. He and the Donald have been friends for many, many years, along with Paul Manafort and other notables in this strange story. Roger Stone has gotten the fame I think he always wanted.
So what is Stone's alleged connection to WikiLeaks? Map it out for us.
Well, the U.S. government believes that he served as a channel of communications between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks. And keep in mind that although they don't want to say this in so many words, the U.S. intelligence community believes that WikiLeaks is a cutout for Russian intelligence. The U.S. intelligence community has determined that Russian intelligence hacked the Democratic emails in 2016, and they somehow wound up in the hands of WikiLeaks. Julian Assange can't explain how that happened. Obviously, the U.S. government believes they were passed from the Kremlin to WikiLeaks through some method, and WikiLeaks dumping them on the internet, of course, changed U.S. political history in 2016.
Right. Now, one of the biggest WikiLeaks dumps of the 2016 election came just hours after this.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
So, John Schindler, if Robert Mueller's investigation found insufficient evidence to charge the Trump campaign for criminally conspiring with WikiLeaks or the Russians, what do you think might emerge in Roger Stone's trial?
I think we may get a firmer sense of what the relationship at least was between Stone and therefore the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks and Assange, those two terms being basically interchangeable here. And that alone would be a big step forward in our understanding. What really were the connections? I mean, Stone wanted people to believe he had a direct link to WikiLeaks. Now, of course, he denies that. What is the truth of this story? I mean, with Roger Stone, you can't put it past him that he really was making a lot of things up to make himself look important and valuable. We need in this trial to find out what was he making up and what was real and what was he hiding.
So you've argued for years that WikiLeaks is a Russian asset. What is your evidence?
I think the evidence is pretty clear if you look at it fairly. They were deeply involved in getting Edward Snowden from Hong Kong to Russia. It was a WikiLeaks employee who literally escorted him to Moscow in June of 2013. They have been deeply involved in that operation and several others that have hurt U.S. intelligence and the U.S. government. And, you know, Julian Assange makes very clear that his bias is pro-Russian and anti-American. I think the U.S. government certainly has evidence, which may or may not come out at trial, depending how secret it is, showing that WikiLeaks, in fact, and again, is a fully winning cutout for Russian intelligence and has been since at least 2013, perhaps earlier.
So there are plenty of journalists and activists who argue that despite the various dramas that Julian Assange has caught up in, WikiLeaks is a virtuous cause. It reveals truths that should not be hidden. How do you respond to that?
Well, I had no problem if they were even-handed. The issue is WikiLeaks has always striven to reveal the secrets of law-based Western democracies, especially the United States and its friends. China is engaging in something like genocide against several of its minorities. They don't talk about that much. Russia has engaged in horrible crimes against its own people in Chechnya and elsewhere. Where's WikiLeaks' discussion of that? If they're seeking to reveal the secrets of governments, why don't they start with governments that already have no accountability to their own citizens and abuse their own populations? That would be a good start for me, and it would show them that they are, in fact, standing up for the truth and citizens' rights, not taking one side, in effect, in Russia's struggle against the West.
John Schindler, columnist and former counterintelligence officer. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Nigeria's first-ever submission for an Oscar for Best International Film has been disqualified. The Academy Award organizers say the movie Lionheart includes too much English language. The World's Rupa Shenoy has more.
The biggest legacy I will leave for posterity is you, my daughter.
The main character's father says that in the movie Lionheart.
But when he gets sick, the father bypasses his daughter and chooses a man to run his business.
His reasons have nothing to do with you being a woman.
When the man in charge runs her father's business into the ground, the daughter has to pull it back from the brink.
Lionheart is in severe debt.
The film was acquired by Netflix. It stars and was directed by award-winning Nigerian actress Genevieve Naji. She funded the film and was interviewed by CNN about it last year.
It's provided an environment where I could showcase the things that made me proud of our culture, our talents, our values. It was really about that authenticity.
The 90-minute film has just under 12 minutes of dialogue in the Igbo language of southeastern Nigeria. This year, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences renamed the category of Best Foreign Language Film to Best International Feature Film. But the rules for the category haven't changed. The Academy still defines an international film as having predominantly non-English dialogue. So Lionheart's been disqualified. The reaction to the Academy's decision was swift, and it was led by Hollywood director Ava DuVernay. She pointed out in a tweet that English is one of the official languages of Nigeria. That's a result of it being colonized by the British. Are you barring this country from ever competing for an Oscar in its official language? DuVernay asked. The director, Naji, in her own tweet, said Lionheart represents the way Nigerians speak. We do not choose who colonized us, she wrote, adding that English acts as a bridge between hundreds of native languages. Many of Nigeria's biggest film productions have primarily English dialogue.
This is the reality of Nigeria as it exists now. And the film wasn't created to rectify the realities and the consequences of colonialism.
Mukhtara Yusuf is a Nigerian artist and academic who focuses on colonial studies.
It's reflecting a language reality that is very common in Nigeria, especially for people of certain classes. And I don't see why there should be any punishment for really honestly reflecting that reality.
But there are those who say that Lionheart doesn't represent Nigeria well. Nigerian Uduak Nwang is a social media consultant.
Speaking English and using English is like you're putting on an image that is not you. You're trying to celebrate the people that colonized you or telling them, oh, yeah, I'm still not matured. I'm still a baby.
And a rule is a rule, says Nigerian director Obia Malanye. He says Naji probably made Lionheart in English to get the biggest possible audience. But there are plenty of Nigerian films made in native languages like Yoruba and Hausa.
I think to argue that English is our official language, so we should be allowed to submit a foreign category film, if you look at it logically and with all lack of sentimentalism, you'll find that it doesn't hold much water.
For its part, the Nigerian Oscar Selection Committee says in a statement that from now on, it intends to submit films that are mostly in native languages, not English. They're urging Nigerian directors to keep that in mind when making films if they want to be considered for an Oscar. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
This week marks 30 years since the Berlin Wall came down, and people who lived in a divided Berlin are today reliving the stories of the chances they took to help people on the other side.
We've got a plan. We want to dig a tunnel into the east to try and help other people get out.
But tunneling under in Cold War Berlin to rescue Berliners in the east, that carried a lot of risk.
They knew that this was an escape operation that could kill them.
Join us tomorrow here on The World for that story. And stay with us all this week as we mark the fall of the Berlin Wall. Nearly 3 weeks ago in Lebanon, anti-corruption protests and blockades across the country put pressure on the government in Beirut. Then last week, Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned. Demonstrators say that's not enough. They want a new government entirely. This protester, Doa Danawi, said, "How am I supposed to get married or raise children? Nothing is changing. It has been 30 years and they haven't done a thing." Still, many in Lebanon support the status quo, like Alain Aoun, a member of parliament and the nephew of Lebanon's president.
When you ask for removing the whole system, then you are calling for chaos and anarchy. The best way is to go through the institutions and hear the people's voice and go for the reforms.
Beirut was once known as the Paris of the Middle East. After World War II, that French influence made Beirut a vibrant center of cultural and intellectual life in the Mideast. But downtown Beirut has gone through a lot of changes since the 1970s. Alex Atak took a spin of Lebanon's capital for us. He's with our podcast partner in the Middle East, Kerning Cultures.
When you visit Beirut, one of the first things you learn is that downtown isn't where people live or hang out. All of the popular bars and the residential areas and the grocery stores, they all fall either side of this arbitrary circle of land that's just broadly called downtown Beirut.
You know, it was actually a very soulless place, very much driven by reconstruction efforts by Saad.
This is Nicholas Cosmatopoulos. He's an anthropologist at the American University of Beirut. We'll get back to him in a second, but first, a 30-second history lesson. When the civil war ended in Lebanon in 1990, downtown Beirut was unrecognizable and basically uninhabitable. It's where much of the fighting happened and divided Beirut into two sides, east and west. So the prime minister at the time, Rafik Hariri, he created this company called Solidaire to take charge of the reconstruction of downtown. Hariri, by the way, was also the founder of Solidaire, which made it this half-public, half-private enterprise. Anyway, they rebuilt downtown entirely. What were the souks before the war is now a shopping mall that could be anywhere in the world. There's Zara, H&M, Prada, a ton of high-end designer stores. That's what Nicholas was talking about a minute ago when he said soulless.
It made it actually an exclusive place for rich people, for tourists. It's like a facade. It's like a shopping mall of sorts.
And they were focusing strictly and only on profitability through real estate.
This is Jamil Malwad. He's Nicholas's colleague, a lecturer in politics at the American University of Beirut.
So that's why you see some very fancy private buildings, but any space that brings people together and, you know, creates a public has been delayed intentionally by Solidaire because they want basically to guarantee profitability.
So in this very, it's worth mentioning here that this feeling that the government prioritized profit over the public good, that profit doesn't trickle down to basic infrastructure like public utilities, this is exactly what the protesters in Lebanon are trying to highlight. And downtown Beirut was like a perfect metaphor for it. Because historically, as in pre-1975, downtown Beirut was a place for the people, a place where people actually lived and where they actually spent their time.
You had like a Medina, you know, a typical, you know, old city style where you had different merchants.
And there are these two buildings that stand out as easy contrasts between the new Solidaire vision of downtown Beirut and the old pre-war cultural hub downtown Beirut, the Egg Cinema and the Grand Theater. They're both on the same street, about a block down from each other, on the same side of the road, and they both look out over the new Solidaire downtown, but they're completely untouched by it.
The egg looks like a big egg, and it's a cinema. You're supposed to be a cinema, but it's the relic now. I mean, it's empty now.
I don't really know how else to explain what it looks like other than to just ask you to imagine a giant grey concrete egg hovering above the ground on pillars.
No, it's somehow as if it's hanging in the air, in the abstract. So,
and the Grand Theatre, a few blocks down the road, I feel like the name says everything you need to know about it. It's literally a grand theatre, four or five stories high, giant arch pillars over a balcony that overlooks Beirut. It's beautiful. But both of these buildings are closed off, separated from the road by construction fencing and closed off for public access since the 1990s.
I mean, it is a present absence in the middle of everything, in the middle of this new Beirut downtown. It's kind of a haunting presence, you know, like a ghost.
So when the protests started at the American University of Beirut, if you remember, that's where both Nicholas and Jamil work, they closed their doors until further notice. And Jamil, Nicholas, and a bunch of other lecturers, they saw this as their chance to take their lectures outside, elsewhere in the city.
So I realized that some people are coming in the Grand Theatre, Le Grand Théâtre, of Beirut, which was closed in 75 because of the war.
And people were freely climbing in and out through a gap in the fence, so Jamil followed them in.
It's like any other opera house in the world. It's different stories. But you see that, you know, the scars of the war, some graffiti.
And he's walking about this place, seeing how excited, you know, people are that they have access to this building for the first time.
So I thought, why would I not give them the talk on the site itself?
So that's what he did. That evening, he gave a lecture to some visiting students in the ruins of the theatre. Across the street and around the same time, early in that first week of protests, Nicholas went to scope out the other building I was talking about a minute ago, the Egg, to see if it would be possible to host lectures inside of it.
It has a good acoustic inside. You still have the stairs. and the seating function of the amphitheater of the cinema. So it was great, actually, for teachings, you know, in terms of the architecture. But at the same time, you know, it was an amazing place, practically speaking, you know, architectonically speaking. But symbolically, it was actually also bringing us back to a pre-war Beirut, where the center was very much populated by everybody. You know, I mean, it was.
I should say, though, these buildings are not safe. I mean, in the Grand Theater, there are these doorways that open out into two-story drops. Rickety ladders that you're supposed to climb across to get to a new level. The staircases have crumbled.
You know, it's also a bit scary because you don't know, are you going to just fall through a hole, you know?
And there was Nicholas and his colleagues called their lecture series in The Egg the Eggupation. Throughout the week, they hosted a series of talks about capitalism, about the future of the protest movement. The talk we went to was sort of like an open mic. The host would ask an open-ended question like, what's wrong with the country? And audience members had a minute to get up and answer however they liked. It was sort of like group therapy. By the time I spoke to Nicholas at the end of the week, he was looking at where else in Beirut they could reclaim for more lectures. It was like the protests had opened up a sort of floodgate, and now any previously off-limits building was open to interpretation. He told me that the Egg had taken on a life of its own, and that he was happy it had been reclaimed by the protests, but it's not up to him to say what happens to it next.
You know, why should we actually not move into claiming property that has been actively stolen from the public or has been excluding the public from it? And we can at least reintroduce a debate about how to think otherwise about these spaces.
Hosting lectures in the Egg or the Grand Theatre obviously isn't a long-term solution to Beirut's public space issues. But Beirutis being able to get inside these spaces and see more of their city's history for themselves is one of the small, unexpected ways that these protests in Lebanon have started to bring about change in the country. For The World, Alex Atak, Beirut.
Alex's story came to us from Kerning Cultures, a podcast telling stories from the Middle East. And we've got photos of the Egg on our Instagram, at PRI The World. From Beirut back to Boston, we close our show from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.